Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 66, with the continued coverage on the connection between racism, COVID-19, and other health issues. It's Friday, June 12th. I am coming to you from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio. Let's start with a local COVID-19 update. In Lucas County from a month ago, identified new infections have been dropping steadily and quite dramatically, less than half of what they were. This drop has been significantly faster than the decline in Ohio, which has dropped about one-third. Hospitalizations have also dropped steadily in Ohio and Lucas County over the last month. This is great news for Ohioans, as most other states have fared much worse and are seeing increases or steady, slow burns of infection. Okay, two episodes ago, I said that I would get an answer to the question of the apparent discrepancy of having more cases reported in nursing homes than we have had reported overall in Lucas County. Well, I spoke with the epidemiologist at the Toledo-Lucas County Health Department, and she cleared this up. It turns out that so-called cases are reported differently for nursing homes. For nursing homes, cases actually equals active cases, which may remain active for several weeks. Unfortunately, this is defined and reported differently by different nursing homes, so that's not a particularly great statistic. But the bottom line is that new cases in nursing homes are not really new cases that week. And since a case probably lasts 2 weeks or more, the actual new cases that are reported is likely less than half of what are actually reported by the Ohio Department of Health, these active cases, which they just call new cases. So that's a little confusing, and unfortunately, the Ohio Department of Health did not list any definitions on their website, which is so burnt for them. Okay, well, the good news on the ground here in Lucas County, in nursing homes, long-term care facilities, this last week we had a drop of about 30% of these active cases, dropping from the previous week of 312 active cases down to 220 active cases. Still a lot of cases, still represents a big proportion of the epidemic here locally, but we are going in the right direction. Okay, I would like to take a little bit of a moment just to do a little public health education here, talking about the difference between incidence versus prevalence, as brought up somewhat by this discrepancy in the way that things are reported. Okay, incidence is like the number of new things that happen. So for instance, incidence would be the number of new diagnoses of diabetes in a year, say. Whereas prevalence would be the number or percentage of people who have diabetes at any given time. That is, even if they were diagnosed 50 years ago, or 20 years ago, or 3 years ago. Of course, when you have a disease of short duration, like COVID-19, giving cumulative cases doesn't really make a lot of sense. And the cases and deaths that are cumulative are increasingly less useful than reporting new cases and new deaths, i.e. the incidence. Incidence gives a more accurate and relevant picture of where the epidemic stands currently. So when we talk about the cases being half of what they were a month ago, That's a lot more important than talking about the cumulative cases, which includes all the cases since the beginning of time, which isn't very long in COVID-19, but it's an important thing to understand how things are reported. Now, I used to work in HIV/AIDS in the 90s, and HIV/AIDS only started in the early 80s, and even up into the late 80s and early 90s, you'd see a lot of this like cumulative numbers of total cases that have ever occurred, which is helpful to understand the overall impact for society over a long period of time, but it's not particularly helpful in understanding what is the epidemic doing right now. Now, of course, with HIV/AIDS, since HIV infection is persistent, meaning it never goes away, it does make more sense because the incident infection, a new infection, even if it happened 5 or 10 years ago, and assuming the person's still alive, that is also a prevalent infection, a current infection, because it persists. So a little difference between the infectious diseases, very different between COVID-19 and HIV/AIDS. Okay, let's talk just a little bit about testing in Ohio. In his daily media briefing on April 24th, Ohio Governor Mike DeWine announced that the state will significantly increase its testing capacity. DeWine said, quote, "Beginning this coming Wednesday, April 29th, our capacity will be at least 7,200 tests a day, and that number will go up to 15,000 by May 6th, 18,500 by May 13th, and 22,000 by May 27th. So basically going from 7,000 to 22,000 in like 5 weeks. Okay, the good news is that we have doubled the amount of testing over the last 6 weeks. The bad news is we only actually reached about two-thirds of that goal that Governor DeWine announced. And now Ohio is testing at a rate about two-thirds of the national rate. We ranked 41st among states in total tests ever done, and we ranked 38th among states in tests performed during the most recent week. So still not doing really great as far as testing in the state of Ohio relative to other states and the nation as a whole. Okay, a little reminder as we're reopening businesses. One of the practices that businesses do is temperature screenings and symptom checks. And these can be useful, but it's as one layer of protection. But it's also important to understand, to not get the sense that these protect us that well from protect us in that it shows us a high proportion of the infections that are actually there. For instance, if you're using temperature screening or thermal scanning with a best-in-class scanner, that would miss over 86% of existing infections at that point. You know, in other words, if you were screening your workers coming in, you would identify 14% or less of the actual infections by doing temperature screening or thermal scanning. Now, if you're doing symptoms check with a best-in-class symptom screener, you would miss generally over half of the cases. So again, you might identify some, but it is hardly a foolproof method. Just one more layer in our battle to beat back this virus. Okay, well, we've had some good news for Lucas County in Ohio, but we had a big epic fail for Ohio, and actually qualifies an epic fail even for the United States. Ohio led the way with the two largest single sources of infections in prisons in Marion and Pickaway counties, and now we've done it again. This from the Ohio Immigrant Alliance. New report, Morrow County failures led to mass illness and death. Morrow County Jail ignored multiple protocols in COVID-19 pandemic, leading to 100% positive in the facility. A new analysis from the Ohio Immigrant Alliance shows that during the COVID-19 pandemic, the Morrow County Correctional Facility failed to follow its own infectious disease control program, as well as the national detention standards required in its contract with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. So this is a major fail for immigration detention facilities. Okay. Because of this, the Morrow County Correctional Facility is now the first county jail in Ohio and the first Immigration and Customs Enforcement detention center in the United States to be 100% COVID positive. You almost have to work to do that. According to the new report and evidence, none of the inmates and detainees at Morrow County have been seen by a doctor in the facility, despite their COVID diagnoses. Nursing staff are not present at the jail overnight or on weekends, and even when they are, they often decline to provide health care, including Tylenol. Jail staff have reportedly refused to call an ambulance for detainees in serious distress. What's more, there are no interpreters available to translate detainee medical conversations, calling into question how jail staff are even making such life or death decisions in the first place. Several of these problems were first documented in February 2020 by Freedom for Immigrants in a formal complaint sent to the Department of Homeland Security, which has gone unanswered. Laura Chambers Kirsch, MD, said multiple well-conducted investigations and legitimate reports have shown that the conditions in the Morrow County Correctional Facility are inhumane and unequivocally, recklessly endanger the health and lives of detainees during the COVID-19 pandemic. The 2019 National Detention Standards clearly guarantee detainees medical care, including timely responses to medical complaints, as well as staff or professional language services. The level of which this is not happening is ludicrous. Morrow County is not complying with multiple of these standards that have serious health implications. Clean clothing and linens, personal hygiene products, available and functional toilets or wash basins or showers, hot meals with proper nutritional content. As a physician, I am shocked and appalled at the way detainees have been treated and the utter disregard for their safety and lives. Because the Morrow County facility has been unable to comply with these standards, and unable to provide for detainees even the most basic measures to maintain their health and well-being, the only responsible course of action is to terminate their agreement with ICE. Added Joan Lederer, MD, the evidence contained in this new report indicates an immediate need to investigate, by an impartial body, the situation at the Morrow County Jail and all jails in Ohio. It is absolutely wrong for prisoners to be intensely exposed to this deadly virus. Prisoners who have committed no crimes or crimes that in no way threaten others should be released to a safe quarantine situation. By not releasing these prisoners, the whole community and ultimately the whole state is at risk for more COVID-19, as workers come and go into the jail and are also exposed. This is a public health crisis and a moral and ethical crisis. There is no medically safe way to detain people during a pandemic, and the reports from Morrow County Jail suggest practices that are particularly unsafe and have led to a serious COVID-19 outbreak, said Jessica Merlin, MD, PhD, infectious disease physician and associate professor of medicine, the University of Pittsburgh. So shame on Morrow County in Ohio. It's not the way we want Ohio, the heart of it all, to be known around the country. Okay, well, speaking of around the country, this from The Hill. COVID-19 spikes, but most governors signal they're staying the course. The coronavirus is spiking across more than a dozen states, but many governors are signaling they have no interest in bringing back restrictive stay-at-home orders, almost regardless of what happens. Even governors with detailed metrics for reopening have shown little appetite to plan for the inevitable virus surges. Public health experts say there are less drastic measures to take than reimposing lockdowns, but as the virus rages, they warn time may be running short. Once you see your cases rise, it's too late. A rising number of cases signifies a spread that's already happened, said Jen Cates, a senior vice president at the Kaiser Family Foundation. The average number of confirmed cases over a two-week period has doubled or more in Arizona, Arkansas, Oregon, and Utah. South Carolina, Nevada, North Carolina, Florida have all set new highs over a seven-day rolling average. Fewer than a quarter of intensive care unit beds in Alabama and Georgia are available. California, Mississippi, and Arkansas are also reporting record levels of hospitalizations. In Texas, the number of people hospitalized with coronavirus has grown more than 40% since Memorial Day. There are currently more than 2,000 people hospitalized, an all-time high in the state, but Governor Greg Abbott is moving ahead with easing even more restrictions. Arizona's top health official has urged hospitals to activate their emergency plans. The numbers of hospitalizations, cases, and deaths have been rising sharply for 2 weeks and are an all-time high. The data are compelling in our state. Things are getting worse fast, said Will Humble, director of the Arizona Public Health Association and former director of the state's Department of Health Services. If nothing changes, we're going to end up with field hospitals or another stay-at-home order or both. But it doesn't have to be that way, Humble said. Humble accused Governor Doug Ducey of deliberately ignoring the worrisome trend in order to focus on the state's economy. The governor's stay-at-home order expired on May 15th and was not replaced by anything binding. Bars, restaurants, gyms, spas, and movie theaters all reopened, in many cases without even a mask requirement. 2 weeks later, cases and hospitalizations started their rapid increase. During a recent press conference, Ducey said the state is focused on protecting people most at risk, but everyone else should be allowed to participate in the opening of our economy. Ducey said the rising numbers are expected and are the result of additional testing, not lifting the restrictions. This viewpoint has been echoed by other governors across the state who contend an uptick in cases does not necessarily correlate to reopenings. Well, this is a basic failure in basic math for Governor Ducey and others. For instance, in Arizona, there are increasing number of tests from the worst. They were ranking 50 at the number of tests. They may still be, but they're very, very low rated. They have been increasing, which is good. But while they are testing many more people, they're actually seeing an increase in the percent of people that are positive. If you had a set number, an even number, a level number of cases, and you did more testing, you would see the percent positive go down. That is not the case. Governor Doug Ducey of Arizona, you are in serious denial. Okay, well, the country is definitely divided. And this from the Hill. Americans divided on a return to regular routines. Americans are divided on returning to their regular routines about 3 months after the country shut down because of the coronavirus pandemic, according to a poll. A CNN poll conducted by SSRS found that 49% of respondents said they feel comfortable returning to their normal routines after the shutdown, compared to 50% who say they do not. In May's poll, 41% said they felt comfortable returning to regular life, and 58% said they did not. The level of comfort is split among partisan lines, with 73% of Republicans, 53% of independents, and 23% of Democrats polled saying they are comfortable returning to regular life. Out of those who are not comfortable going back to normal life, 17% say they will probably or definitely return to their regular routines by the end of the year, while 32% say regular life will not begin until 2021. A total of 47% of respondents said the worst of the pandemic had already occurred, while 46% said the worst is yet to come. This is more evenly split than in May, when 52% said the worst is yet to come, and in April, when 80% expected the worst ahead. So there you go, folks. We're a divided nation right down the middle there. It's almost like we're living in two countries, one that's dealing with this pandemic, the other, not so much. And even the half that's dealing with it, you got about a third of them or a sixth overall that think it'll be done by the end of the year. Of course, the fall's coming up and that's flu season, and expect a resurgence. That's my prediction. And a lot of experts are saying that's what we should be expecting. Okay, well, some people early on, one of the greatest markers of success, I think, was saying that if we do this right, people will think we have done too much. And I think we may be suffering a little bit of that. But here we go from NPR. Modelers suggest pandemic lockdown saved millions from dying of COVID-19. Two new papers published in the journal Nature say the lockdowns put in place to slow the spread of the coronavirus were highly effective, prevented tens of millions of infections, and saved millions of lives. Our estimates show that lockdowns had a really dramatic effect in reducing transmission, said Samir Bhatt, a senior lecturer at the Imperial College London School of Public Health, who worked on one of the papers published in Nature. Bhatt's team analyzed infection and death rates in 11 European nations through May 4th. They estimated that an additional 3.1 million people in those countries would have died if lockdowns had not been put in place. Without them, we believe the toll would have been huge, Bhatt says. In addition to the paper from Bhatt and his colleagues, Nature also published a separate study from the Global Policy Lab at the University of California, Berkeley. That study analyzed lockdowns in China, South Korea, Iran, France, Italy, and the United States. It found that the lockdowns in those six countries averted 62 million confirmed cases. For example, in the U.S. through the first week of April, there were officially just over 360,000 confirmed cases nationwide. Without lockdowns and other interventions, the researchers at Berkeley calculated the U.S. would have had nearly 14 times as many cases by April 6, more than 5 million confirmed cases. To put this in perspective, the U.S. now, 2 months later, is hitting the 2 million mark. Solomon Hsiang, director of the Global Policy Lab, said these unprecedented shelter-in-place orders came at an extreme economic cost. Yet when government officials were ordering them, it was unclear exactly how significant the social benefits would be. The value of these studies you're seeing today is that they're demonstrating what the benefits of these policies are. Hsiang said in a press call discussing the studies, they averted tens of millions of additional infections and millions of deaths. The two studies used different methods to calculate the number of cases averted by the lockdowns. Bot's team looked at reported deaths to calculate community transmission that occurred weeks before and used the change in death numbers over time to track how much the lockdown suppressed transmission. Hsiang's group at Berkeley used economic models usually used to examine how specific policies impact economic growth. They looked at how daily transmission growth rates shifted as lockdowns went into effect. Despite their different approaches, both groups came up with similar findings. Both sets of researchers also caution that as lockdowns start to ease around the world, public health officials still have very limited tools to combat the coronavirus. Testing is more widely available. Social distancing has become standard at many shops. Most large gatherings at sporting events and concerts remain banned. But the virus continues to circulate. The vast majority of people are still susceptible to COVID-19. Bot also warns that as places come out of lockdown, transmission could rapidly flare back up again without some measures in place to check it. The researchers from both papers say that people need to understand how much of an impact the lockdown measures have been having. Hsiang at Berkeley says that it is difficult as difficult as this year has been, things would have been much worse if millions of people around the globe hadn't stayed home. Without these policies deployed, we would have lived through a very different April and May, a period so bad, he says, that we believe it's probably almost unimaginable. Okay, and another thing about what you can do with this epidemic, the continuing epidemic, this from Live Science. Face masks may reduce COVID-19 spread by 85%, World Health Organization-backed study suggests. Social distancing, face masks, and eye protection all appear to reduce the spread of COVID-19 in both healthcare settings and the general community, according to a new review commissioned by the World Health Organization. The review found that keeping a distance of at least 3 feet from other people lowered the chances of coronavirus infection or spread by 82%, and keeping a distance of 6 feet could be even more effective. Wearing face masks and cloth face coverings were also linked with COVID-19 protection for the general public. The same was true for healthcare workers, but N95 masks provide greater protection in healthcare settings than other types of masks. Eye protection, which people perhaps tend to think about less than nose and mouth protection, may also provide additional benefits in both community and healthcare settings, the authors said. However, the authors note that the findings on face masks and eye protection are based on limited evidence, and overall, none of the practices examined in the study fully protected against COVID-19. Although distancing, face masks, and eye protection were each highly protective, none made individuals totally impervious from COVID-19 infection, study lead author Dr. Derek Chu, a clinician scientist at the Department of Health Research Methods, Evidence and Impact, and the Department of Medicine at McMaster University, Ontario, said in a statement, "For this reason, basic measures such as hand hygiene are also essential to curtail the current COVID-19 pandemic and future waves," he said. For the new review published in the journal Lancet, Chu and his team examined studies on COVID-19 as well as the related conditions SARS and MERS. Overall, the researchers analyzed information from 44 studies involving more than 25,000 people in 16 countries. 7 of these studies involved COVID-19, 26 involved SARS, and 11 involved MERS. The studies examined the effects of social distancing, face masks, and eye protection, such as face shields, goggles, and glasses, on virus transmission. The researchers considered these measures separately rather than in combination. They were not able to examine how a person's duration of potential exposure affected their risk of infection. With social distancing, the chance of infection or transmission of these coronaviruses was about 3% when people kept a distance of at least 3 feet from others, compared with 13% when people kept a distance of less than that. What's more, for every extra 3 feet, up to 10 feet, the risk of transmission or infection of these coronaviruses reduced by half. With face masks, the chance of infection or transmission was 3% with a mask, compared with 17% without a mask, a reduction of more than 80%. And for eye protection, the chance of infection and transmission was 6% with protection and 16% without. Our findings are the first to synthesize all direct information on COVID-19, SARS, and MERS, and provide the currently best available evidence on the optimum use of these common and simple interventions to help flatten the curve, study senior author Holger Schunemann, a professor at McMaster University, said in a statement. Additional analysis in healthcare settings found that N95 respirators were 96% effective at protecting workers in these settings, while other types of masks, such as surgical masks, were 77% effective. These findings show that for healthcare workers on COVID-19 wards, an N95 respirator should be the minimum standard of care, Rayanna McIntyre, professor of global biosecurity at the University of New South Wales Kirby Institute in Australia, and colleagues wrote in a commentary accompanying the study. The review also supports universal face mask use because masks were equally effective in both healthcare and community settings, the commentary said.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me, but the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch, and I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, well, let's get today's focus on racism and COVID-19 and other health issues. First, are people paying attention? Well, this from Pew Research. Black U.S. adults follow many COVID-19 news topics more closely, discuss the outbreaks more frequently. Black Americans, a group that has been hit disproportionately hard by the coronavirus outbreak, have been paying closer attention to many elements of the outbreak and discussing it more frequently with other people than other U.S. adults, according to a Pew Research Center survey conducted before nationwide protests began over the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis. Both black adults were much more likely than whites and somewhat more likely than Hispanic adults to frequently discuss the COVID-19 outbreak with other people. Roughly a quarter of black adults said they discuss it almost all the time, more than twice the 10% of white adults who said the same, and more than the 19% of Hispanic adults who said the same. About half of black adults were very closely following local news about the availability of COVID-19 tests, nearly twice the share of white adults at a one quarter, and higher than the 31% of Hispanic adults. A similar portion of black Americans, 47%, said they were very closely following the status of nearby hospitals, again about twice the percentage of white adults at 24%, and also substantially higher than the share among Hispanic adults at 32%. And this from The Hill, researchers face hurdles in examining COVID-19 racial disparities. As the country reels from days of unrest in major U.S. cities, as Americans protest police brutality and racial inequality, researchers are working towards quantifying the disproportionate impact the coronavirus pandemic has had on minority communities. What they are finding is that pre-existing racial disparities in the United States contribute to more coronavirus-related deaths among minority groups, while also making it difficult to quantify the differences. Though most U.S. states report some coronavirus date broken up by race, Much of it is incomplete, primarily due to the fact that some private labs don't collect racial data. An April analysis from the Kaiser Family Foundation found that the majority of states reporting data that include race and ethnicity, Black people and Latinos account for a higher share of confirmed cases and deaths compared to their share of the total population. But the numbers that exist alone don't tell the full story. Researchers at Yale found that when adjusted for age, preliminary data now suggests that Latinos who are collectively younger than white Americans face a significantly higher risk of death than is reflected in raw data. In Wisconsin, data suggests Black COVID-19 patients are 18 times more likely to die of COVID-19 than white patients, while in Pennsylvania, data suggests they're only slightly less likely to die of COVID-19 than whites, Yale found. Knowledge remains limited in part because, according to information collected by Johns Hopkins University, only 4 states track testing by race. Havadon Rodriguez, president of the State University of New York at Albany, was appointed by Governor Andrew Cuomo to study the impact of COVID-19 in minority communities and work toward increasing testing in those communities. His team of researchers are exploring the following factors: housing and food security, an individual's ability to work remotely, how individuals learned about the danger of COVID-19, their level of risk, and what options of testing were available to them, the availability of health insurance coverage and access to health care, and existing mental and behavioral health diagnoses. These are situations and issues that have existed long before COVID-19, and they are broad, Rodriguez said, adding that disproportionate impacts are visible in nearly every crisis America has faced. Every time we have an emergency or disaster, would be Hurricane Maria, Hurricane Katrina, all of a sudden these issues once again are at the forefront, Rodriguez said. They were not created by COVID-19, but they are indeed exacerbated by it. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, minority Americans tend to live in multi-generational housing in densely populated areas. They are also more likely to be further from grocery stores and medical facilities. Minority populations are also overrepresented in jails, prisons, and detention centers, where outbreaks have been common, and are more likely to work in essential industries without paid sick leave, the CDC found. Carlos Rodriguez-Diaz, an associate professor at the George Washington School of Public Health, noted that undocumented people also tend to lack labor and health protections guaranteed to U.S. citizens. Latinos are often challenged by the fact that it's very hard to get a job, so once they have one, they want to keep it, even when the conditions are not necessarily conducive to staying healthy, he said. Health literacy is typically lower in communities of color, partly because health information is tailored for an English-speaking audience before it is translated to other languages. In Latino communities, particularly those of relatively recent immigrants, misinformation spread on the online messaging app, WhatsApp, and Facebook is rampant. I think one solution that we have is to make sure that we respond with strategies that are culturally congruent with Latino communities in the United States, Rodriguez-Diaz said. Stephen Thomas, director of the Maryland Center for Health Equity, said Black Americans tend to distrust government institutions, including public health agencies, because of a cultural memory of when people in white coats came and said, "I'm here to help you," and instead they were there to abuse them. "You cannot disconnect what's happening in Minneapolis from what's going on with COVID-19, Thomas said, referring to the death of George Floyd, a 46-year-old Black man who died in police custody. The message that sends to so many Black people and other people of color is, we don't matter, and if COVID-19 is taking us out at greater proportions, the government doesn't care," Thomas added. Most scholars agreed that focusing resources on disproportionately impacted communities is likely to have a positive impact on the population as a whole. For example, the Department of Health and Human Services began focusing anti-HIV resources on the 48 U.S. counties, Washington, D.C., and San Juan, Puerto Rico, where 50% of new HIV diagnoses in 2016 and 17 occurred. And the approach has been taken for the HIV epidemic globally is precisely investing more in the communities that are disproportionately affected, Rodriguez-Diaz said. Okay, this from the New York Times. For a day, scientists paused science to confront racism. Galvanized by the reaction to the killing of George Floyd and continued reports that minority researchers feel marginalized and disrespected, almost 6,000 scientists and academicians said they would participate in a one-day strike on Wednesday. The event was organized by a loosely affiliated group of physicists and cosmologists operating under various hashtags, including hashtag strike for black lives, hashtag shutdown STEM, and hashtag shutdown academia. Participants plan to cancel classes, lectures, or committee meetings, hold off on reporting any breakthroughs, and forego engaging with email and reading draft articles for peer review. Instead, they would devote the day to a close examination of how science does business. Racism in science is enmeshed with a larger scheme of white supremacy in society, said Brian Nord, a physicist at the Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory in Illinois and one of the organizers of the strike, repeating a phrase he attributed to his co-organizer, Chanda Prescott Weinstein, a cosmologist at the University of New Hampshire. We need to rethink what scientific collaboration should look like. Black people need a seat at the table. He added the idea is to disrupt the system, at least for a day. As of Wednesday morning, some 5,700 scientists had signed a pledge to strike, and registration was closed. The petition reads, in part, "We recognize that our academic institutions and research collaborations, despite big talk about diversity, inclusion, and equity, have ultimately failed black people. Demands for justice have been met with gradualism and tokenism," the organizers said, "and black students still often feel unsupported and unwelcome at predominantly white college campuses and laboratories. Many leading scientific journals, including Science, Physical Review Letters, and ArXiv, an online platform where physicists post their preprints, have all said that they will be silent on Wednesday. In a notice sent to reporters on Tuesday, the prominent journal Nature, which publishes new research papers every Wednesday, said it would hold off on doing so until Thursday, with the exception of breaking news about coronavirus. Nature condemns police prejudice and violence. We stand against all forms of racism, and we join others around the world in saying unequivocally, Black Lives Matter, their statement read. We recognize that Nature is one of the white institutions that is responsible for bias in research and scholarship. The enterprise of science has been, and remains, complicit in systemic racism, and it must strive harder to correct those injustices and amplify marginalized voices. Okay, and this from Scientific American magazine. Racism, not genetics, explains why black Americans are dying of COVID-19. There's still plenty we don't know about COVID-19, but one fact is inescapable. African Americans are disproportionately represented among the dead. Although the numbers are incomplete, the nonprofit APM Research Lab estimated that as of May 27th, the overall death rate from COVID-19 is 2.4 times greater for African Americans than it is for white people. It is easy to lose sight of what this ratio really means, the human toll it represents. So let's be clear. If black people were dying at the same rate as white Americans, at least 13,000 mothers, fathers, daughters, sons, and other loved ones would still be alive. One would expect this staggering inequality to provoke outrage. For some, it has. But much of the public and scientific reaction has instead invoked baseless ideas about unknown genes that make African Americans vulnerable to the virus, rather than focusing on abundant evidence for the devastating biological consequences of systemic inequality and oppression. The racist idea that vulnerability is intrinsic to blackness comes from politicians, scientists, physicians, and others. In an NPR interview, Louisiana Senator Bill Cassidy, who was a medical doctor before entering politics, claimed without providing evidence that, quote, genetic reasons, among other factors, put African Americans at risk of diabetes and therefore of serious complications from COVID-19. Scientists writing in The Lancet, one of the world's leading medical journals, suggested, also without evidence, that ethnic disparities in COVID-19 mortality may be partly attributable to, quote, genetic makeup, and speculated on a, quote, genomically determined response to viral pathogens. Epidemiologists writing in Health Affairs noted that there may be some unknown or unmeasured genetic or biological factors that increase the severity of this illness for African Americans. This racialized view of biology is not only wrong, but harmful. Nor is it new in medicine, as documented in Dorothy Roberts' Fatal Invention, Rana Hogarth's Medicalizing Blackness, or Harriet Washington's Medical Apartheid. For starters, we know that race is a poor proxy for human genetic variation. Compared to other primates, humans exhibit remarkably little genetic variation, a consequence of our relatively recent origin as a species, and the variation that does exist is patterned geographically, not racially. Consider skin color, which varies gradually from the equator to the poles, but never reveals a discrete break corresponding to distinct races. Quote races. Genetic variation, moreover, does not come in neatly colored packages. For example, the genes that influence skin color are distributed independently of genes that influence a risk for any particular disease. Given the heterogeneity of groups we call black or white, treating those categories as proxies for genetic variation almost always leads us astray. How then do we explain that black and white still predict biological endpoints like hypertension, diabetes, or, now, COVID-19? The answer is straightforward. Human biology is more than the genome. Our environments, experiences, and exposures have profound impacts on how our bodies develop, turning genetic potential into whole beings. Most of us learned this lesson in high school. Phenotype is the product of genotype and environment, but we tend to forget it when it comes to race. If we take the lesson seriously, it becomes clear that systemic racism is as much a part of biology as genomes are. The conditions in which we develop, including limited access to healthy food, exposure to toxic pollutants, the threat of police violence, or the injurious stress of racial discrimination, influence the likelihood that any one of us will suffer from high blood pressure, diabetes, or serious complications from COVID-19. Unfortunately, this whole person view of biology remains uncommon, even in fields where it should be widespread. Consider a highly cited 2006 paper in Human Genetics by Hua Tang and colleagues from the University of Washington and the University of California, San Francisco. The researchers analyzed data from the Family Blood Pressure Program, a sizable clinical study, to test whether DNA-based estimates of genetic ancestry, which they tellingly dubbed, quote, racial admixture, predicted body mass index and blood pressure in Mexican-American, African-American adults. Tang and colleagues concluded that their results were, quote, suggestive of genetic differences between Africans and non-Africans that influence blood pressure, though they acknowledged that genetic effects were likely to be small compared to environmental ones. In suggesting a genetic basis of racial disparities in blood pressure, Tang and colleagues reprised a long-standing but unsubstantiated assumption that people of African ancestry are predisposed to hypertension. This assumption matters anew because some are invoking it to account for racial inequalities of death rates from COVID-19. Rena Robinson, a professor of chemistry at Vanderbilt University, told NPR that African Americans can be characterized as, quote, potentially having genetic risk factors that make them more salt sensitive, an apparent reference to a widely disseminated yet discredited hypothesis for hypertension, which suggests that the Atlantic slave trade created conditions favoring salt-retaining genotypes among enslaved Africans and their descendants. Robinson noted that there are likely to be additional causes. In fact, billions of dollars worth of effort to find alleged genetic contributors to racial disparities in cardiovascular disease have turned up nothing. The study by Tang and colleagues illustrates two common errors that allow racial genetic thinking to persist. The first, remarkably, is that the study found no statistically significant relationship between African genetic ancestry and blood pressure. The suggestion of genetic differences, then, clearly reaches beyond the data. Such unwarranted inferences are not as rare as you'd think. In April, the Journal of Internal Medicine published a paper asserting a genetic basis for racial differences in obesity without actual genetic evidence. The second problem is more subtle. Recall that Tang and colleagues examined two biological variables, genetic ancestry and blood pressure. If they found an association, they assumed it was because of some unidentified genetic variants that A, increased susceptibility to high blood pressure, and B, were more common in people of African ancestry. Yet they did not test that assumption, nor did they pursue the alternative possibility that biological associations could be driven by sociocultural processes. It is easy to take the logic used by Tang and colleagues for granted. Most researchers assume that genetic ancestry is related to health through genetic effects. But what if genetic ancestry and blood pressure are linked because of systemic racism rather than DNA? What if people with more African ancestry in a racist society are more likely to be poor, they are, to experience discrimination, they do, or to face any number of other stressors we know are associated with high blood pressure? Evidence indicates such connections are better explanations than alleged genetic differences. Not long after the Tang study came out, Amy Nan, then a PhD student in anthropology at the University of Florida and now an associate professor at the University of California, San Diego, took a hard look at the underlying data from the Family Blood Pressure Program. She noticed a single crude proxy for the wide-ranging consequences of systemic racism: educational attainment. Working with myself and Connie Mulligan, a genetic anthropologist and Nan's advisor at Florida, she replicated Tang and colleagues' analysis of genetic ancestry and blood pressure, but added years of education as another variable. Whatever evidence there might have been for genetic effect evaporated. Instead, as we reported in the American Journal of Public Health, every additional year of education is associated with a 0.51 millimeter drop in blood pressure on average. Genetic ancestry added nothing. In the time of COVID-19, this finding is a reminder that genetic ancestry might matter only because we think it should. If we assume that people who are racialized as black or white are fundamentally different and treat them accordingly, the paradoxical result is that it will produce the very biological differences we presume to exist in the first place. But it's not because of any deep-seated differences in our DNA. It's because our social structures and attitudes promote the well-being of some and devalue others. In his NPR interview, Cassidy downplayed the role of systemic racism as a root cause of COVID-19 inequalities. "That's rhetoric, and it may be," he said. "But as a physician, I'm looking at science." However, the science does not say what Cassidy thinks it does. Thanks to decades of careful research, we know that what we gloss as race corresponds poorly to genetic variation, and we know that racism is deadly. An ethical, scientific response to COVID-19 demands that we honor the highest standards of evidence in evaluating genetic guesswork while measuring the biological cost of systemic racism and intervening to stop it. Okay, well, this next story really ties in how systematic racism plays out to cause all kinds of health problems. This is a very different health problem, this from The Guardian. Omission of air pollution from report on COVID-19 and race, quote, astonishing. The failure to consider air pollution as a factor in the higher rates of coronavirus deaths among minority ethnic groups is astonishing and wholly irresponsible, according to critics of a Public Health England review. The Public Health England report confirmed the disproportionate impact of COVID-19 on people from ethnic minorities, but did not mention air pollution. Minorities in the UK, US, and elsewhere are known to generally experience higher levels of air pollution, and there is growing evidence around the world linking exposure to dirty air to increased coronavirus infections and deaths. Scientists said air pollution should absolutely be considered, and that it could have a double effect, with long-term exposure weakening lungs and hearts, and short-term exposure potentially making viral infection more likely. Before the pandemic, air pollution was estimated to cause 40,000 early deaths a year in the UK, about the same number as the official UK coronavirus death toll to date. Air pollution is linked to diabetes, strokes, heart attacks, asthma attacks, and with these underlying health conditions, are dying more from COVID-19. Some people will say air pollution in itself is racism because, yet again, it disproportionately affects black people. COVID-19 has just made it more obvious. And I have a whole slew of stories that I will get to in the next episode talking about racism and environmental justice in the environmental movement. So stay tuned for next week. But I wanted to close with what I think is a beautiful example. I guess maybe I should rephrase that. An ugly example of how medicine and the medical community are complicit in white supremacy. This from Scientific American. George Floyd's autopsy and the structural gaslighting of America. The world was gaslit by misreporting about George Floyd's initial autopsy report. As concerned physicians, we write to deconstruct the misinformation and condemn the ways this weaponization of medical language reinforced white supremacy at the torment of black Americans. Gaslighting is a method of psychological manipulation employed to make a victim question their own sanity, particularly in scenarios where they are mistreated. The term comes from a 1938 play and later a popular film wherein a predatory husband abuses his wife in a plot to have her committed to a mental institution. He dims the gas lights in their home. Then, when she comments on the darkness, knowingly rejects her observation and uses it as evidence that she's gone insane. It's a tortuous tactic employed to destroy a person's trust in their own perception of reality. It's a devastating distraction from oppression. It's insidious. And it happened recently when millions of people had seen 9 agonizing minutes of murder were told by an autopsy report that they hadn't. In America, widespread anti-black violence is often paired with structural gaslighting. Racism, after all, thrives when blame for its outcomes are misattributed. When black families are refused loans in criminally discriminatory housing schemes, their credit is blamed. When youth of color are disproportionately stopped and frisked, they are told the process is random and for their safety. And when black people are killed by police, their character and even their anatomy is turned into justification for the killer's exoneration. It's a well-honed tactic. One analysis of the National Database of State-Level Death Certificate data found that fewer than half of law enforcement-related deaths were reported. In addition to this undercounting, police actions were further minimized by the use of diagnostic codes that incorrectly labeled the cause of death as, quote, accidental or, quote, undetermined, rather than police-related. For centuries, our systems have relied on this psychological torture, a host of mental gymnastics, to deny the truth of what black people have always known. The cause of death is racism. On May 29th, the country was told that the autopsy of George Floyd, quote, revealed no physical findings that support a diagnosis of traumatic asphyxiation, and that, quote, potential intoxicants and pre-existing cardiovascular disease, quote, likely contributed to his death. This requires clarification. Importantly, these commonly quoted phrases did not come from a physician, but were taken from a charging document that utilized politicized interpretations of medical information. As doctors, we wish to highlight for the public that this framing of the circumstances surrounding Floyd's death was at best a misinterpretation, and at worst, a deliberate obfuscation. A timeline of events illustrates how a series of omissions and commissions regarding Mr. Floyd's initial autopsy results deceptively fractured the truth. On May 28th, a statement released by the Hennepin County Medical Examiner's Office reported ongoing investigations and acknowledgement from the forensic pathologist that a, quote, autopsy must be interpreted in the context of the pertinent investigative information. As per standardized medical examination, Floyd's underlying health conditions and toxicology screen were documented. These are ordinary findings that do not suggest causation of death. Yet headlines and the May 29 charging document falsely overstated the role of Floyd's coronary artery disease and hypertension, which increased the risk of stroke and heart attack over years, not minutes. Asphyxia suffocation does not always demonstrate physical signs, as other physician groups have noticed. Without this important medical context, however, the public was left to reconcile manipulated medical language with the evidence they had personally witnessed. Ultimately, the initial report overstated and misrepresented the role of chronic medical conditions, inappropriately alluded to intoxicants, and failed to acknowledge the stark reality that but for the defendant's knee on George Floyd's neck, he would not be dead today. But Monday, June 1st, in the context of widespread political pressure, the public received two reports, the preliminary autopsy report commissioned by Floyd's family by private doctors, and, shortly after, a summary of the preliminary autopsy from the Hennepin County Medical Examiner's Office. Both reports stated that the cause of Floyd's death was homicide, death at the hands of another. By inaccurately portraying the medical findings from the autopsy of George Floyd, the legal system and media emboldened white supremacy, all under the cloak of authoritative scientific rhetoric. They took standard components of a preliminary autopsy report to cast doubt, to sow uncertainty, to gaslight America into thinking we didn't see what we know we saw. In doing so, they perpetuated stereotypes about disease, risky behavior, and intoxication in black bodies to discredit a victim of murder. This state of affairs is not an outlier. It is part of a pattern and tactical distortion of facts wherein autopsy reports are manipulated to bury police violence and uphold white supremacy. As Ida B. Wells said, those who commit the murders write the reports. A similar conflict of interest between police departments and medical examiners' offices continues today. As physicians, we will not be complicit in the ongoing manipulation of medical expertise to erase government-sanctioned violence. Though we are relieved that two independent examinations invalidated the preliminary findings in the charging document and the headlines that deceitfully undermine Chauvin's culpability in Floyd's murder, our initial incense is not replaced by celebration. For 3 days, black Americans sat and still sit with the all-too-familiar pangs of being told that the truth is not true, of fearing that the law would believe a physician's report over the reality they saw with their own eyes and have lived with their own lives. It's a miscarriage of justice that deepens the cut. Not only can black people be killed with impunity, a physician's autopsy report can be twisted to replace the truth. Medical science has long been used for the consolidation of power rather than for solidarity with the oppressed. We see how black mothers are blamed for their own mortality in childbirth and how starkly high rates of COVID-19 death in black communities are preposterously misattributed to differences in hormone receptors or clotting factors, all while letting racism off the hook. We wish to remind fellow physicians that medical science has never been objective. It has never existed in a vacuum. There have and will always be social, political, and legal ramifications to our work. Our assessments may be employed in criminal justice cases. Our toxicology screens may have profound effects on the livelihood of patients. Our diagnoses may perpetuate sexist and racist stereotypes. Our lack of ill intent cannot be our alibi. We must be accountable for not just our work, but also how it is used, lest our medicine become the very weapon that harms. Medicine requires inclusion of the social context of disease in order to uphold its sacred oath of doing no harm. If we focus only on molecular pathways and neglect to articulate the role of structural inequities of racism in our country, our reports on the causes of death and injury in our patients will erase the roles of their oppressors. We also write to remind our physician colleagues that the medical field is a place ripe for gaslighting, bolstered by the perceived strength and legitimacy of a white coat and a stethoscope. Our diagnosis and conclusions about physical or psychological abnormalities, about causes of illness and death, have the power to eclipse reality, as we've seen in the case of George Floyd. Often we stand by while other agents co-opt our frameworks, obscure our research, and weaponize our language in the service of oppression. The declarations, the truth, the realities of black people in America are too often disregarded. Across the nation, black people are suffocating under the weight of anti-black hatred. They cannot breathe. And even as they gasp for air, structural gaslighting operates to deny the truths of the causes of their suffocation. We write as physicians to denounce this psychological manipulation. We write to apologize for the discrimination our patients of color have received in the hospital under our watch. We write in gratitude for the tireless labor of black activists. And we write to condemn how medicine has been weaponized in the service of white supremacy. We write to validate what black people already know. We have always known that racism is a most pressing public health crisis. We pledge to fight this crisis as if our own breath depended on it. Okay, well, that does it for today's show. If you'd like to review this show, listen to any previous show, or queue up future shows, please go to toppun.com, toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Or if you'd like to get Facebook notices, you can go to facebook.com/justforhealthWAKT. And the 4 is the number 4. So just for health WAKT for the Facebook page. And if you have any questions, feel free to email me at WAKT@toppun.com. Thank you for spending this hour with me. My second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.